On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, this is The Conversation Hour with John Fain.
You're going to meet some very interesting new film stars in a moment. Chloe and Sam are coming in, and they're two of the stars of a film called Jeremy the Dud, which is about how, well, really, people who don't have disabilities are duds, and the people who, in this world, populated in this film, people with disabilities are by far the majority, and there's the occasional sad sort of, you know, intruder who is without a disability. They've turned it around for the purposes of this film, Jeremy the Dud. So Chloe Hayden and Sam Humphrey are coming in, and they'll undoubtedly take us through it in good form shortly. My co-host for The Conversation Hour today is a bloke who's written a book. Nothing unusual about that. He's written a book that makes you laugh. That's starting to get a bit unusual. Written a book that makes you laugh about Muslim terrorists. That's now becoming extremely unusual. Tony Martin, broadcaster, writer, actor, all the rest of it as well. Now also is a comic novelist. Morning to you, Tony.
Good morning. I'm just getting used to the idea of getting down to Conversation Hour level, John, because usually when I come in here, I've done about five very loud FM breakfast shows, so I've been talking like this. So now I've got to just get down to the Conversation Hour level.
That's better.
It's a bit of an adjustment for me.
And you can use words that have more than three syllables.
Okay, I'll work some up.
Ideas that might be a little more complicated.
Sure.
And you've got to sustain a conversation that goes for more than 3.5 minutes.
That's right. And I'm not hosting a phone in about what's the weirdest place you've had sex.
What have you lost down the toilet?
That's right. It's always a good one.
Yeah. In fact, though, there is a radio presenter of kind,
yes,
of a particular species as a character in your new book, which I should very quickly say is called, what is it still called, Deadly Kerfuffle?
It is, yes. Where there was talk of changing it to Schmozzle, but we've settled on Kerfuffle.
Good, Deadly Kerfuffle. It's about a bunch of, well, a family of Maoris who move into a suburban home in Melbourne, and the neighbours all think they're Muslim terrorists.
That's right, because are Maoris Islamic? No one's sure, at least in the world of this book. This was based on something that happened. I used to live in a town called Hamilton in New Zealand, and there was a street that had 20, I guess here they're called like housing commission flats. These were houses, weatherboard houses, state houses we call them. And the seventh one along was on a different angle to all the others in the street. And word went round our school that, oh, Egyptians have moved in and they've turned the house to face Mecca. Now, I'm assuming this wouldn't be true because it would be enormously expensive to turn a house on its axis. And if you were on social welfare, presumably you couldn't afford to do that. But this became accepted as fact in the town of Hamilton. For like a decade later, I remember people still talking about this as if it had actually happened. So what I did with this book is I thought, let's imagine if that rumour started in a quiet suburb in Melbourne and just have everything spiral out of control.
Which it rapidly does.
Yeah, well, there's a protest rally.
Spoiler alert, how much do we give away?
Well, the whole beginning of the book, I guess, is sort of written on the back, so we can say that. But yes, there's a protest rally to protest the proposed Islamic rotation of the house, and the local paper has a diagram of the house revolving with un-Australian intent. And of course, there's no plans to revolve the building at all, and it's all just a misunderstanding. But by that time, it's too late. And by the end of the book, it sort of becomes a Tom Clancy thriller. My idea was to start with an Ealing comedy and have it turn into a Tom Clancy thriller.
There's misunderstanding upon misunderstanding upon misunderstanding.
That's right,
and that is what comedy is based on. There's a, it might be my particular bias here, but there is a radio talk host character.
Yes, there is. It's not based on you, John, if that's what you're about to ask me.
No, quite. Well, if it had been, as I read about this character, I would have been somewhat upset, and I probably would have cancelled your appearance on The Conversation Hour today.
Well, it's
it is a sort of send up of the classic shock jock idiot on commercial radio.
Well, I've used just bits and pieces I've heard about so many of them. I think there's a scene in there where he's talking about his biography. A friend of mine worked on a book by John Laws years ago, And it was one of those books where it's, you know, John Law's Great Aussie Yarns, and they're all sent in by listeners. And it was John Law's and someone else, and like, you know, like a co-writer, and that person's name was Tiny.
Yeah.
But when you looked at the author bio, that person's bio was quite long, but John Law's bio said simply, John Law's is simply John Law's. That was his biography.
So and he's getting money from having his name on the cover.
That's right.
So that's about all he's contributed to this book.
So I've used that, and I remember once being in a studio like we're in now and looking through the glass, and John Law's was about to go on air, and two blokes came in white coats with a wooden box, which they opened, and it was like a beautiful felt-lined wooden box, and they had cotton gloves on, and they lifted out a gold microphone, which was installed, replacing the normal microphone in the studio in preparation for John Law's coming in to do his show.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as you know, all radio
What's unusual about that?
What have you got over there? Oh, hang on. It's a strontium microphone.
Yeah, we've got two people in pink coats here at the ABC who come in with special gloves on, disposable gloves, and they come in and they clean the place out in order to just declutter it and get the chewing gum off from underneath the desk where Red Simons has left
Red
it from the morning breakfast show. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I've just accumulated little pieces of information, details like that, and just used lots of them. What interested me was there was, of course, Stan Zemanek. Do you remember years ago, I think he's no longer with us, Stan
Zemanek. He's no longer with us. You can say whatever you like, but don't be too cruel. He was a performer.
That's
as
right.
Much as anything else. He was a right-wing shock jock in Sydney who came down and chanced his arm in Melbourne and completely bombed in the ratings.
That's right. But what I always remember hearing, people who work with him said that he was totally different off-ear than what he was like on-ear. So that, to me, is a more interesting character. So that's what I've tried to do with the character
in this book.
He
was poking a stick in the ant's nest as a broadcaster whilst apparently a lovely man in real life.
That's right. So that's a much more interesting character than just having a horrible, you know, shock jock host.
Yeah.
So, yeah,
no shortage of them to borrow from, though. All no. the same. Now, why did you decide that Maoris would be the...
Well, I wanted to get some New Zealand connection in there, and I remember you would always hear stories about... This is in the years... Because I've set the book in 2006, in the years after September 11, when it didn't seem possible that there could be any kind of terrorist activity in Australia, in a much simpler time, as I say.
But a time of great anxiety.
Yes, but you would always hear that... Because I have, you know, a lot of friends of mine from New Zealand, and they say, oh, have you had the call from the embassy, and you have to guard your... If you've got a New Zealand passport, you have to... passport, pardon me. You have to, you know, put it in a safe because terrorists are very keen to get hold of New Zealand passports.
Specifically New Zealand
ones. To get into Australia. So I remember... So I've just used... What I've done is I've taken all rumours and items that I've found in the Your Say section in the paper and just put them into this giant stew. And, so I've got characters saying, oh, yes, well, they're from they're Pakistani, but they've come here via New Zealand. I think these New Zealanders need to go back to Pakistan where they come from. So I'm just using all of those kind of misunderstandings for comic effect, hopefully.
Kerfuffle, a disturbance or commotion.
There you go.
Typically caused by dispute or conflict.
It's, I think, some sort of Gaelic or possibly Celtic word. I think it begins with a C. I think we've... Australia has turned it into a K word, possibly.
Do you know what a fuffle was?
What was that?
A fuffle was Scottish English, 16th century, meaning to dishevel.
Right.
The addition of the prefix ker for carfuffle, Scottish Gaelic, meaning wrong or awkward, didn't change the meaning. It just doubled it up. Wrong dishevelled or wrong problem. Mm. So it's sort of like tautological.
Nobody...
So it could be just deadly fuffle.
Well, it could be. But I must say, on none of the FM breakfast shows have I had an entomological discussion about the origin of the title. Beautiful.
I apologise. And no arguments about Deadly. None.
No.
None whatsoever. So you've had a lot of fun with this. When's the film deal being signed?
I can't imagine that there would be a film of that. But, who knows?
Yeah, I'm sure you can imagine it.
Well, I always think most novels... Don't you think most novels... are kind of ruined when they get turned into a film because there's too much to squeeze in. I think short stories make for a better film. So I remember years ago they did that.
Depends how long the film has to be.
Well, I tell you what, I watched recently The Fallen Idol, the Carol Reed film with Ralph Richardson, made in the just before The Third Man back in the late 40s. Graham Greene short story. And short stories are generally the perfect length for a movie. Stand By Me is another great film that's made from a short story. Then you end up with films like, remember Bonfire of the Vanities? Remember what a debacle that was?
Yeah, tried to get too much in.
And you go, that would have been a brilliant, they should still do it. They should do like a 10-part miniseries for HBO.
That was just cancelled House of Cards. Have you heard about
that? Yes, well, there's been some trouble.
Netflix have just said that after Kevin Spacey has been accused of inappropriately assaulting a 14-year-old boy,
right?
Then they don't really want to go ahead with another series, so the sixth and final series of House of Cards will be the final one. They're not going to do any more.
Right.
Although they were thinking of finishing it anyway, they say.
So they're making it right. That must be a very strange day's work with all that in the papers, and then you've got to go and film something with Kevin Spacey. That must be a strange set.
I think they might have finished already.
Right.
So they were, the expectation was that they would be continuing into a seventh, but now they're saying no way.
In the last series,
the shockwaves going through Hollywood are just extraordinary at the moment.
Because the last, I mean, I don't want to give it away for people who haven't seen the fifth series of House of Cards, but it
hang on.
No, I'm not going to
give, spoiler alert.
There's not going to be any plot details,
ding, ding, ding.
What they did was they had Robin Wright's character start talking to the camera. And that was quite startling because for five series she'd done nothing when her husband was speaking to the camera.
Typically that's what you do. You know, he got assassinated and they keep going in series 7, 8, 9 and 10.
That's right. So surely they would just...
With a dead president.
Bump off Kevin Spacey and it would be Robin Wright's House of Cards.
Well, she keeps going. She's taken control already in series 6.
Is there that sort of trouble? Have you done that on this show?
Sorry. Oh, no.
Don't do that.
Oh, well. Tony, congratulations.
Thank you.
You're gainfully employed. That's good to see.
Yes, hanging in there.
And doing all sorts of television stuff as well?
Not really. I occasionally did pop up on Have You Been Paying Attention 3 or 4 weeks ago and scored literally the lowest score in the history of the program. So I think that's been...
It's notoriety. But didn't you direct an episode of something recently I saw?
I did a few episodes of Upper Middle Bogan.
Ah, that's what I was thinking
Which was a lot of fun. That's a great cast to work with. Robin Nevin. It's a lot of fun.
They're doing more of that?
I'm not sure. I didn't work on the third series. I'm not sure if there will be a fourth.
Well, they didn't ask you back.
Well, they were. I was otherwise occupied doing this book.
Oh, so, excellent.
Yeah, but I think, you know, Michaela, if it was America, if we were making Upper Middle Bogan in America, I think Michaela Bannis would already have. Remember how there would always be in the 70s, there would be Rhoda and Alice and Maud. I think.
There'd be a spin off.
There would be an Amber series because that's. People love that character from Upper Middle Bogan.
Outstanding.
All the characters are good. I'm not suggesting they aren't, but that character really caught on with people.
Tony Martin's new book, Deadly Kerfuffle, and look, there's a laugh on every page.
Well,
sometimes
hopefully.
Even more than one.
There's one on the imprint page. There's a good legal disclaimer. That's always fun.
As my co-host on The Conversation Hour today, our next pair of guests on The Conversation Hour today are the stars of a new short film created by Robot Army Productions, made in Geelong, with a not-for-profit organisation. The film is called Jeremy the Dud. And it stars our next two guests, Chloe Hayden and Sam Humphrey. Morning to you, Sam. Morning to you, Chloe.
Hi.
Hey.
Tell me the premise very briefly of Jeremy the Dud, Sam. What's it about?
So basically it's in a world where everyone has a disability, except for a few that don't have a disability, and we call them the duds. So basically they go out into the world and they sort of experience what it's like to have a disability. And it's a very thought-provoking, film. And basically, I think it sort of explains what society is a little bit like today. That's good.
And so there's one person in the film who doesn't have a disability, and that's the one person, and they're a very rare part of the population in this new world. So, Chloe, what's your contribution to it?
Who do I play? So I play a character called Heidi, and Heidi has autism. She's so similar to me. I'm so excited that I get to play a character like her.
To play yourself, basically.
I literally get to play myself. It's great. It's amazing. Basically, I think Heidi would probably be the only voice of reason in it. Everyone else is, quite honestly, quite nasty to Jeremy. They talk down to him and they ostracize him and they treat him like a child when he's, you know, a fully grown adult. And Heidi's the only one that, I guess, picks up on it and questions why people are doing this and why people are treating him differently, because at the end of the day, he's the same as we are. We're all people. We want to be treated the same way, and no one else seems to get that.
So, Sam, that's what Chloe plays. What role do you play?
So I play Jai. I play Kyle's best friend on the show, who is Heidi's brother. And so basically we sort of go out and we try and sort of help Jeremy find a job and whatnot. But I'm not very nice to Jeremy. I basically treat him like a four-year-old.
And is that how people treat you sometimes?
To be honest, it's how I feel all the time. I am basically a little bit like Jeremy. I get treated like a kid when I'm out and about doing shopping and whatnot. And it actually happened to me the other day. A person brushed past me. He's like, "Oh, how you going there, little buddy?" And I'm like, "Okay, that's cool. Very nice." I just let him walk by, but I whispered to myself, I'm like, I could tackle you right now, but, you know, I won't let you know that.
I know it's always a rude question with actors, but how old are you?
I am 23.
Wow. There you go.
Yeah.
So you haven't had any work done. Let's just point that out.
Thank you very much.
And because it's radio, we have to fill in the missing piece in the jigsaw puzzle. So why is that remarkable?
Well, I just think it's sort of, it highlights on those keys, like for me, being short and sort
very,
of
very, very short.
You're very short, yes. 127 centimeters.
Yep.
It sort of shows that people make those kind of comments without like getting to know you, and it's kind of like the way that I project that onto Jeremy. And even though he is like, you know, normal and he can go out into, you know, the world and be completely normal.
So you get to turn the tables.
Yeah, pretty much.
So to speak. And Chloe, you get to be yourself. So Sam has to pretend to be the people who make his life miserable, but you get to be yourself.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's cool.
It's kind of not fair, really, is it?
Oh, no, I love it. I love it. I think it's so cool to play a character which is so similar to myself. I guess she's kind of a projected version of who I try to be. She's, you know, she's loud and she's stubborn and she says her mind and she doesn't care what other people think about that, which I think is really cool. And in all honesty, I think more people should be like that.
So you self-describe as an Aspie?
Yes, I do. So I have autism. I was diagnosed at the age of 13. Yeah.
And what does that mean in your daily life then?
I guess the way I like to describe it is everyone has a certain set of traits and quirks and personality things and things that make them them. And my ones just happen to have a name to it. And the things that I have just happen to have a label, and I'm okay with that because I like labelling things.
I haven't heard Aspie. Is that an Australian way of saying that?
I don't know. I think it's just, you know, it's a short, you know, kind of gives it a little bit. Saying autistic or saying autism or saying Asperger's, it's long and it's formal and, you know, I'm an Aspie and I'm cool with that.
That's good because I, you know, I have hemochromatosis, which is a genetic iron-storing blood disorder, and we're called hemochromatoids. That's really
great. Wow. You guys, yeah, that's amazing. You sound like robots.
Hello to any hemochromatoids listening to the show.
Amazing. Well, see, I call myself Princess Aspian. So I started a YouTube channel and a blog and a website, all that, a few years ago, and saying girl with autism sounds a bit, you know.
Yeah. Or on the spectrum.
On the spectrum, or saying ASD. It sounds a little bit dull mundane.
Sure.
And my main audience, I guess, is more children. And I think the word Aspie and the word Aspian and the word, you know, putting it, making it a little bit more lighthearted and fun, I think it kind of makes it seem less down and in the dumps, because it's not.
Not many people listening would think that, for instance, for either Sam or Chloe, that going through life with various disabilities would not, to most people, seem to be fun at all. But you're making it out to be fun.
Well, I think you have one chance at life, you know, and this is the cards that we've been dealt. And I think it's really important to live your life with whatever card you've been dealt and, you know, have the good days. And don't think about what you can't do. Think about, hey, I can do this and I have this opportunity and we have the most amazing opportunities. And I think if you think about all the bad things or you think about the negative things, then what's the point?
It does tend to, like, get you down when people try and to project, like, all the bad stuff onto you. Like, I mean, many times people will say, like, why are you trying so hard, or, you know, why are you trying to be, like, you know, achieve all this stuff. I mean, sometimes it is because you want to, you know, you don't want to think about all that negative stuff because it does get you down. But I mean, you know, like Chloe said, you've only got one life, so you live it to the best that you can possibly live it and achieve as many great things as you possibly can.
And I don't want to accuse you, Sam, of name-dropping, but we were talking out in the corridor before and you announced that you've just made a film with Hugh Jackman.
I have, yeah.
No. Hugh Jackman's just made a film.
Yeah, that's right. He has. And there's quite a big... tell us about that.
So I did just make a film with Hugh Jackman. It's to do with the story of P.T. Barnum and the Traveling Circus.
Barnum and Bailey.
Yeah, Barnum and Bailey Circus.
Great story.
So I play Tom Thumb, who's a pretty big character in the story of how P.T. Barnum sets up the circus.
Tom Thumb was one of the sideshow freaks yes. in the early days of circus performances.
He was.
Have you been to New York?
I have, yes. That's where we actually shot the principal photography.
Did you go to the Freakatorium on the Lower East Side?
I unfortunately did not get the chance to.
That sounds amazing.
Is that a nightclub? What is that?
I don't know if it's still there because it's some years ago when we were on holidays and we discovered that there was this private collection that's been set up as a public museum called the Freakatorium.
Oh, wow.
And inside is Tom Thumb's original costume.
No way. Whoa.
Amongst many other things, including two-headed sheep.
Oh, mate, get me on the next plane to New York. I am there.
A whole lot of stuff.
I love stuff like
someone
that.
Someone who is clearly very resourceful, meaning with a lot of money, someone has acquired a whole lot of curiosities and then assembled them into an old shop and you're charged entry and it's called the Freakatorium and I can't recommend it enough.
I am so there.
I'll have to go there next time I'm in New York.
Someone showed me a photograph on the internet of from a, quote, freak show from the Victorian era and it was come into this tent and see the colossal woman and it was like the world's fattest woman and there was a photograph of this woman, and it was a woman who would be these days considered slightly portly. So obviously,
want your money back?
Yeah, obviously in that era,
and bearded lady.
There weren't that many.
Yes, we had our bearded lady. She's an opera singer. It was amazing.
So when's the film coming out?
So it comes out Christmas Day and Boxing Day
this year.
Yeah.
Oh wow! So, have you had a chance to see any of the rushes or anything?
I've seen the trailer, but I am going to the premiere on December 8th.
Where's that?
In New York. So.
Hey, Freakatorium, here you come.
Here I come, yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. And what the actual experience itself, how was it?
I can only describe it as out of this world. It was amazing. To work with, like, my idol, Hugh Jackman, he's been, like, my idol since I was 8 years old. So I was a little bit starstruck when I first met him, I will admit that. I forgot who he was briefly, but, yeah. It was amazing.
I'm looking forward to this now because I love that whole world of circus and sideshow. I think it's endlessly fascinating. So when's your big break going to come, Chloe?
Jamie the dog, that's it.
Stay tuned.
Well, it's we're talking New York premieres, but Jeremy the Dad, is it the first film made in Geelong, is it? I mean, I don't want to offend anyone, but...
I mean, there's obviously been small things done.
Yeah.
But as far as I'm aware, Jeremy the Dud is the first potential big thing that has come out of Geelong, which is great, because Geelong is such a great little town.
Sure.
And it's it deserves to be on the map. It's a great place.
It is.
And I guess this definitely, puts it on there.
They have a news agents and Tants Lotto venue that's inside a replica of the Sphinx. And I always like to say that the Egyptian Sphinx is copied from the Geelong Sphinx.
They've just got none of their own ideas, have they? That's just the thing.
That's right.
Congratulations. Now, Jeremy the Dud, the short film made in Geelong with the not-for-profit organisation Gen U, which used to be called, it was a charity called Coringle St Lawrence. So it's made about people with disabilities by turning the table. So the person in the minority and who's patronised and condescended and given a hard time is the person who doesn't have a disability. Mm. It premieres at 5 p.m. on Thursday on Facebook.
Mm.
Now, how's that? That's pretty wild in itself.
I think obviously, not many big things are premiered online or on Facebook especially, but I think the way that this has been done and I think the audience that it's aimed at it works for that sort of audience. And I think, you know, it's so easy to share things like that and to get the message across.
So I understand the clips of it and the like of which we were provided with, they've gone viral and it's clearly going to...
Insane.
Well, given that Sam is co-starring with Hugh Jackman in the next big Hollywood release, playing in Jeremy the Dud, Jai is Sam Humphrey, and playing Heidi in Jeremy the Dud is Chloe Hayden, also known as Princess Aspian. And you're getting your own fan mail, both of you now. So watch out. On Facebook, on Thursday, November the 2nd, which is the day after tomorrow, from 5 p.m, you can go to Facebook and look for Jeremy the Dud.
That's right. You're going to have to have your own premiere at your house.
My dad hasn't seen it yet. He was in Sydney on the premiere that we had, our own little one. So I'm going to like set up the whole house and be like, right.
Just a bit of red carpet.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Second red carpet. How
yeah,
we come.
Exactly. Yeah, go to Spotlight.
Sam can ask you, you know, what you're wearing.
Oh, totally.
You have to totally match.
This is my onesie from eBay. Yeah.
Well, then I'll have to wear my onesie from eBay.
Get John Michael Housen to come to your house and commentate
amazing.
The
celebrities.
Well, they
don't deserve that. Look, I think clearly we're going to hear a lot more from both of you, and congratulations.
Thank
Chloe
you so
Hayden
much.
And Sam Humphrey, who play various roles in Jeremy the Dud, which will be on Facebook from 5 o'clock on Thursday this week. Just look for Jeremy the Dud on Facebook after 5 o'clock on Thursday. Our next guest from Save the Children, Matt Tinkler, is just back from Bangladesh, where he's been visiting refugee camps for the displaced Rohingya. So I'm sorry, we're going to do a bit of a U-turn and go from being kind of having fun and talking about aspiring, brilliant new actors to talking about one of the greatest humanitarian disasters, if not genocides, taking place in the world today. Sorry to bring the tone down. Tony Martin's my co-host. And Matt, good morning to you.
Morning, John.
Welcome home. Why did you go to Bangladesh?
Well, it's probably the biggest crisis in our region right now, if not for our generation. I grew up in Geelong, and it's fantastic to hear about Jeremy the Dud being made there, but three times the population of Geelong has fled Myanmar to Bangladesh in the last 2 months alone. So over 600,000 people, half of them are children, more than half children, have fled with basically just the clothes on their back, fleeing extreme violence in Rakhine State in Myanmar, and they're now camped in a place called Cox's Bazar, or just next door in Bangladesh. And I went to visit those refugee camps in Cox's Bazar.
Bangladesh, needless to say, is one of the poorest countries on earth already. So how do they cope with 600,000 extra people?
With amazing generosity, I've got to say. So Sheikh Hasina, the Prime Minister, famously said, if we can feed 160 million Bangladeshis, we can feed half a million Rohingyans. And, you know, you compare that with the response of Tony Abbott when he was Prime Minister and asked if we would resettle some Rohingyan refugees who are stuck in the Andaman Sea. And he famously said, nope, at that time. So the Bangladeshi government and population have really opened their arms to the Rohingyans. The local community have provided land, they're providing services and support. The government of Bangladesh is coordinating services into the camps. It is a phenomenal scale, and they're doing a fantastic job by and large.
We've got, this has been called a genocide because the bottom line is that these are Muslims who lived in what used to be called Burma, now called Myanmar, and the Myanmar government, particularly the military, just are quite happy to push them out.
Yeah.
This is ethnic cleansing in any other way.
Well, that's how the UN's described it. And what I can go by is the families I spoke to in Bangladesh. And, you know, I spoke to a young man who watched his parents shot and beheaded and then muffled the screams of his brother so they weren't found. I spoke to a mother who lost her son, another mother who lost her son and whose husband is missing. Every family I spoke to, and there's probably 50 or 60,000 families in these camps, has a similar story of death and horror. Now, I suspect there's a little bit of story coaching going on, people standing around kind of getting people on message, but even if you discounted that by half, it is going to emerge one day that the number of people who have been killed in Rakhine State in Myanmar is in the thousands, if not tens of thousands. And
so after World War II, the world said, we'll never let that happen again. And then after Cambodia, we said, no, we'll never let that happen again. And then after the collapse of the former Yugoslavia, we said, no, we'll never let that happen again. And after, on and on it goes, I could rattle off another half a dozen examples, and it keeps happening.
Here it is, happening on our watch. And, you know, that's why I'm here today, is to talk about this. you know, it's a little bit like disability, that there's not enough mainstream conversation about the barriers that people with disability have in the world. And likewise, we would think there's not enough public conversation about these atrocities or the scale and the need in these places in Bangladesh. And one of the things, the takeaway from me from these camps, it's a really difficult terrain. They're jungle-covered hills and people are terracing out these hills to pitch their bamboo and black plastic tents. And in between, there's little, what were little creeks, now essentially creeks of human filth that people are crisscrossing on bamboo poles. You know,
there's no sewage, let's be blunt about it. There's no
sewage,
facilities.
No,
you know, there's no running water.
Food.
It's all just water is in bottles. There's no running water. There's no.
There's a river that runs through the middle of the camp, and I walked for 10 kilometres one day with our country director, and we saw maybe a quarter of this, and we stood on a hill at the back of the camp and said, how the hell are we going to get 20 kilogram bags of rice to this point because there's a river through the middle that trucks can't get through? And what we will do is pay refugees to carry it by hand and on their heads and shoulders to get it to those far-reaching points of the camp.
What about disease?
Disease is a big risk at the moment because of the lack of sanitation facilities. So we're running a thing called our emergency health unit right now. The government of Bangladesh is doing a mass vaccination campaign for cholera. We're doing a lot of health screening. The vaccine won't prevent cholera. It will lessen the impact. So we still need to have rehydration clinics, those kind of things. That's a massive risk. The risk, child protection risks are huge. I was at the show before I went with my son, and you know,
you were where?
The Melbourne show. You get an armband for your kids now at the show where you can write your mobile phone number. But I still lost my son for about 10 seconds and had this moment of sheer panic, right? And I was thinking, when I was in this camp, there's no lights. It's a ramshackle, haphazard development. You know, you go over one hill and it looks like the next. You imagine if you're a parent and you lost your child for a couple of minutes in this camp, you would absolutely have a heart attack.
Be like lion.
Right. And it is. You know, there's 500,000 people more in this scenario. So the risk to children are huge. None of them are in education, for example, at the moment. We know that education is one of the most protective things we can do. Get kids back into routine, get them away from the risk of exploitation, get them learning again. But because we are focused at the moment on the life-saving humanitarian support, education needs to come next. But we need to think about that. You know, I think when I was on your show previously, I was back from the Middle East talking about that crisis where people have been for 5 or 6 years now in Jordan and Lebanon and Turkey. And it probably took us a little bit too long to start thinking of a longer-term response in that crisis and to think about things like education. So we need to learn those lessons, and we need to do that quickly in this crisis now.
And where do you get your funding from for all this work?
The Australian government has been really generous in that respect. So they've funded $30 million to this response so far. So the children's benefited from about $3 million of that, which we're doing this water and sanitation, latrines, shelter, food distributions. We run things called child-friendly spaces where you just provide a space where kids can come and play, you know, facilitated play. It's like a informal sort of education. So it's mainly from government at the moment, but we are running public appeals as well right now. So if you go to savethechildren.org.au, you can donate. And look, all of the other big aid organisations are doing similar things and running their own appeals.
So longer term, is it intended that these become communities or that they be dispersed throughout
It's a
Bangladesh.
Really sensitive question right now. So from the government of Bangladesh's perspective, you know, as you said, they've got their own challenges for their own communities. And when you ask the refugees, the Rohingyans, many of them would like to go home if it's safe.
To Burma, to Myanmar.
Yeah, I mean, that's where they've lived their
but
lives.
How can they think it's going to be safe if this has been done by the military and Aung San Suu Kyi is powerless to do anything about it? She's completely beholden to the military, and that's been made abundantly clear. If she tries to speak against them, they'll just put her back in prison or something.
And that's the big problem. So that's why no one's going anywhere anytime soon. And they're mixed. Some of them have said, I don't ever want to go back. What I've seen is horrid, and I can't return.
You can understand that.
But the government of Bangladesh is in a dialogue right now with the government of Myanmar about a return scenario. But from our perspective, it could only ever be countenanced if there was guarantees around safety and, importantly, the rights of people. So prior to this mass displacement, the rights of the Rohingyans were virtually non-existent in Myanmar. They were in I was in camps in January, IDP camps, internment camps effectively.
IDP, internally displaced people.
So they don't have citizenship rights, they don't have freedom of movement, they don't have access to government services. Those things are being provided by aid agencies in camps in Myanmar, or were. A a lot of that's been disrupted by the violence and displacement. So if they were ever to return, we'd want guarantees around, you know, their basic rights as other citizens in Myanmar. But for the time being, what we want to do is guarantee their safety and their rights in Bangladesh, where they're located right now.
When you have a look, I mean, the theme of the film, Jeremy the Dud, is about how what's quite normal, in inverted commas, can be turned around. There's nothing normal about the plight of the people here, and yet this is their new normal.
It is. And, you know, one of the things that struck me when I was there is it's the resilience of people is phenomenal. And despite all of this hardship and the scale and the conditions, people were going about their business because they had to. They had to build shelter, they had to collect firewood, they had to collect food, they had to cook.
And kids will play with a bottle top.
Oh, yeah.
Or an old tyre. It's extraordinary when you... I mean, I've visited a few, nothing like what you have, but I visited a refugee camp when there were people coming out of Vietnam.
Right.
And they were in Hong Kong in shipping containers. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Well, you're probably not old enough.
I'm not old enough, really.
It was extraordinary. Three layers, one on top of the other. And kids would play with a cardboard box.
Yep. So the kids running around with bottle caps on the end of a stick here, they were having a ball. And and the spirit in the camp was actually quite positive, notwithstanding all of this horror. When you had to sit down with families to unpack some of the trauma and grief. The one thing I'd say about that is one of our big concerns is the people we can't see. So people with disability, adolescent girls who are scared to come out of their tents, the elderly who don't easily access services. There is a big part of the population who aren't coming out of their tents that we're not seeing. So it's really important that we try and access them.
And these are people who are, by and large, subsistence farmers?
Correct.
In Myanmar?
Yep.
They're not educated. Many of them wouldn't even be literate in their own language. They're living a subsistence existence, incredibly poor to begin with.
That's right.
And what little they did have is gone.
Is gone, yeah. The villages have been razed, burnt to the ground, by and large. And that's the common story I got from talking to families there.
Do you know what's going on back on the other side of the border then, on the Myanmar side? Are there people who are not ethnic Rohingya, but Burmese or whichever groups, taking the land that these people used to survive on?
It's really hard to know what's going on because there's very little access for NGOs and UN agencies, in particularly Northern Rakhine State, where most of the violence has occurred. What we've heard is some declarations by government that camps burned to the ground become government property.
And then do they put people in who they want to try and create as, again, the new normal? As the
That's the concern,
So the land, you can never go back because the land's now occupied by someone else. Yep. With government and military backing.
That's right. There's been some supervised visits from diplomats, with diplomats and other UN agencies, but from what I've heard, they've been very limited in what they've been able to see. And there are still some people, there's still some hundreds of thousands of people who are in Northern Rakhine State who we're not able to access right now. And the real concern there is that they're not getting enough food and water and things to survive. So that's driving this continual movement. You know, in the last week, another 14,000 people arrived in Bangladesh.
Trivial matter, I know, but I have been saying Burma. Is that now wrong? Have I been... Is that offensive?
It depends who you talk to, but formally it is Myanmar.
Okay, noted. Duly noted.
And that's been for a little while now, but Burma was the old colonial name.
Yes, but the British and Americans seem to insist on calling it Burma still, but everyone else calls it Myanmar, including the people in Myanmar.
Good.
Do you call Beijing Peking?
No, I just ignore the subject entirely.
No, you don't. I mean, this is part of keeping up with changes that are happening in the world, and this is one of the most complex conflicts in our contemporary world. I mean, the world is full of them. There's what's going on the Korean Peninsula, for instance, and so on. But, in fact, there's insurgencies not just there, but also in Thailand and right through the region. There are little flare-ups that
there's a lot of other conflict occurring and has been for decades in Myanmar. So if you talk to the government of Myanmar, they say, yes, this is a problem, but we have many problems that we're trying to deal with, including wars that have been going for many years in different parts of our country. This one just happens to be at a scale that is, you know, really hard to fathom.
Yes.
The bottom line here is that you can donate to any of the charities that are doing work in Myanmar, and one of them, Save the Children, have sent Matt Tinkler in, their Director of Policy and International Programs, who's just back from visiting the region known as Cox's Bazaar in Bangladesh, where a lot of these people now have been relocated. Save the Children have got a big campaign going, and their website or their phone number would both provide you with an opportunity to make a donation. Savethechildren.org.au or 1-800-760-0011. There are other charities active in the area, and you're welcome to choose whichever one it is. But whatever charity you choose, it doesn't, to me, really matter. It probably does to Matt, but the world needs to help here. The Bangladeshis are one of the least able countries in the world to deal with a problem of this magnitude, and they can't do it on their own. There's just no doubt about it. Matt, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on.
It's not a pretty picture that you paint, but one that's important that we know about it. Matt Tinkler from Save the Children, Sam Humphrey and Chloe Hayden from Jeremy the Dud, Tony Martin, his book's called Deadly Kerfuffle, and they've been in the studio for The Conversation Hour today on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.